Good morning and welcome to everyone. Our first case today is In Re Estate of Klinger. Mr. Holbrook, good morning to you.
Good morning. Hope everybody's well today. May it please the court, counsel, my name is Brad Holbrook, and I represent the appellants who were the contestants at trial in this matter that comes before this court on the petition for further review from the Nebraska Court of Appeals ruling of January 2015. Today, my clients are asking this court to consider at least two very important issues. The first issue is whether or not the trial court erred in failing to instruct on the presumption of undue influence when my clients unequivocally had proven the existence of a confidential relationship coupled with suspicious circumstances. I think as part of needing to answer that question, this court is going to need to, or at least I am calling on this court to answer the question that was left unfinished by this court in 2009 in its In Re Hedke decision, and that is, what exactly is the quantum of proof necessary to rebut a presumption of undue influence? Frankly, I think it goes, the issue can really be captioned as this. In a bench trial such as Hedke, obviously the trial court is the determiner of all facts. And so it makes sense that the trial court is making a decision as to whether or not a presumption arises, whether that's rebutted, and ultimately whether or not undue influence exists. However, as in this case, when we have a jury question, the question is, who gets to decide that issue? Is it the jury or is it the judge? We believe that the case law on the topic is such that the jury is the ultimate determiner as to, one, whether a presumption exists, two, whether it's been rebutted, and then three, ultimately, the issue for the jury, was there or was there not undue influence?
Mr. Holbrook, haven't we said in previous cases, perhaps more less recently than Hedke, that the presumption of undue influence really isn't a presumption at all, at least in the sense of a Rule 301 presumption, and it's really a permissible inference of undue influence?
Well, this court has said that, and frankly, there's we spent a lot of time at trial trying to figure out this issue. In Nebraska, as the law sits right now, we actually have two presumptions. There's competing presumptions. There's the Morgan theory and there's the Thayer theory. The Morgan theory, which Your Honor is discussing, is what is codified in Rule 301. And what the Morgan theory says is that if you prove fact A and B, you must presume C. It's mandatory. But the common law on the presumptions that still sits today is that which is set forth in Hedke, which is the Thayer bursting bubble theory. But we actually have two presumptions in the state of Nebraska right now. One is Rule 301, and one is the common law. And there's nothing in the state of Nebraska the common law that has indicated that the common law presumption of undue influence has been abrogated by Rule 301. To the contrary, it's distinguished and said it's not a Rule 301 presumption.
In the context of a burden of going forward with evidence, it may make some sense to talk about presumptions, but given that the will statute unequivocally states that the burden of persuasion is on the contestants, doesn't it make more sense in terms of instructing a jury to talk about inferences?
No, and this is why. As this court stated in Hedke, the trial court clearly got it wrong. This jury sent back four questions to the trial judge, two of which said, is the greater weight the same as beyond a shadow of a doubt? And can you explain to us greater weight of evidence and how it interplays with undue influence? And the court said, I'm not going to instruct you anything. I've given you the instructions. If this court's position is such that we're just going to instruct the jury as in the pattern instructions right now, and you can just think about inferences. One, there's nothing in the pattern instructions right now that allow a jury to rely solely upon inference. Two, it's such
a... Well, when you add the circumstantial evidence instruction to the inference instruction that was given about as long as it's not precisely the same, don't those amount to that?
Well, no. I would disagree, and this is why. The main issue that I have with the failure to instruct the jury, we have this case law that is considerably more helpful and explanatory than the pattern jury instructions. It talks about what a confidential relationship is. It talks about six different suspicious circumstances. Recall, undue influence does not happen in the light of day. It happens in the shadows, behind closed doors. And yet the only instruction we give juries is the instruction that defines undue influence. Well, you know, what good is that going to do you? If you get to instruct a jury that, hey, if you have a close relationship, if somebody has been guarding this person, if it's unjust, if it's unnatural, there's lack of consideration, that the testator is elderly, weakened in a tight spot, lack of independent legal advice, if the jury gets to be told, hey, you get to look at these issues, then I would agree that the instructions as provided are accurate, but those and you can rely upon this inference. I was prevented from even being able to talk about these things because I couldn't talk about it, a presumption of undue influence.
Well, let me ask you this, counsel. Suppose you had the will offered for probate and no evidence was offered by the contestant to the will. Obviously, the person offering the will for probate would win, wouldn't they?
Correct.
Right. In order for the contestant to win, what do you have to prove?
We have to prove undue influence.
Right. And what are the elements of undue influence?
The elements of the prima facie case of undue influence is that the testator was subject to undue influence. There was an opportunity to exert undue influence. That there was the person that was unduly influencing was disposed to do so, and the result was clearly the result of undue influence.
Okay, so if you prove all those, you win, right?
Correct.
But if you don't, prove those, you lose.
Correct.
So what presumptions are we talking about?
Well, the presumption that
is the will was validly and properly executed, and that the testator was not under undue influence. Well, you have to prove that there was undue influence or that she was incompetent at the time she executed the will.
Correct.
What's so complicated about that?
Well, I would refer for this court back to In re Hedke, where a trial judge heard very similar evidence, found no undue influence. This court, four individuals on this panel, heard that case and said, you clearly were wrong. That's my point. If the law is that we're going to just give jurors these four elements and ask them to figure it out, when a trial judge who not only knows these four elements but understands the concepts of this presumption clearly gets it wrong, what are we doing? What's happening out there with our jurors?
Hedke was an equity case, wasn't it?
It
arose in an equity context such that our standard of review was de novo on the record, correct?
I believe that had to do with the setting aside of the deed. But
yes, so it was inequity, and
yes,
we had
inequity.
A de novo standard of review. Here, it's an action at law.
Before your time expires, I do want to briefly talk about the video.
Yes, sir.
And I want to expound just a brief chain of reasoning and have you respond to it. There were two issues at trial. Capacity, undue influence.
Yes, Your Honor.
The trial judge directed out testamentary capacity. The exhibit was received and the jury was instructed, you may not consider it for undue influence. As far as I can tell, the record contains no motion after the directed verdict to strike the exhibit, and there appears to be nothing in the record to object to it going to that exhibit going to the jury room. How can there be prejudice from that exhibit under these circumstances?
The prejudice is the fact that it was played at all. fact that that objection was overruled, the video was played, you can't undo it.
What was your objection?
The objection was that it was cumulative, that it violated our right to cross-examine the witness, and that it, Rule 403, probative value was substantially outweighed by the danger of unfair prejudice.
What year was the video?
2001.
And the second will was when?
2011.
So there was 10 years.
Well, if the court directed verdict on testimony capacity and said that the jury wasn't to consider this for undue influence, there wasn't any reason to give them the video then, was there?
Absolutely, there wasn't.
Did you object on relevancy? Well, you said 403.
I'm not certain
That's
if
right.
I did. I see that I'm out of time. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Vinton, good morning.
Morning, Your Honor. May it please the court and counsel for appellants, I'm George Vinton. I represent Pat and Cal Klinger, the appellees in this case. I want to clarify one thing because I think there's some confusion about the limiting instruction that the trial judge gave regarding that videotape. The Court of Appeals says in its opinion that basically the trial judge instructed the jury not to consider the video whatsoever for undue influence. That's not the case. I'm going to read you the limiting instruction. There are specific questions asked by Mr. Wolf regarding influence and whether Calvin Klinger influenced Mary Ann Klinger. You are to disregard those questions and answers given, and they may not be considered by you as evidence on the issue of undue influence. Well, he's only referring to these questions that Mr. Wolf asked. He says, were you unduly influenced? And she'd say no. The tape itself was good evidence that there was no undue influence because, and I know it goes back to 2001, and it was the will she signed in 2001 that the videotape showed. However, the appellants made it an issue because they said this undue influence started way back in 2000 and that my client somehow unduly influenced Mary Ann Klinger to make that will back in 2001 to give the farm to him. They did not object to that will, that 2001 will, getting into evidence. And there was, you know, Nebraska case authority in the state of Flyer that allows the previous wills to get into evidence to show that the pattern had continued into a subsequent will, you know, of having a certain estate plan. So that's why it was relevant to get the will in. That's why it was relevant. Since the will got in, the jury clearly was entitled to see the video surrounding the execution of the will. And so it was clearly good evidence about whether she's unduly influenced because you could just look at her. The jury could look at her. They could see that she was under her own control. She wasn't being coached. Her answers are very clear and sharp. And there wasn't anybody coaching her.
Was there any evidence that her mental capacities diminished from 2001 to 2010 or 11, whatever it was?
There really wasn't in the end, Your Honor. I mean, there's a whole parade of witnesses that came in and talked about how she was over that period of time, even up to the time of her death.
A conservator was appointed. A conservator was appointed.
Well, if you look at the testimony of John Wolf, they basically caved in. That conservatorship, if you look at the record real close, and you have to look at the whole thing, all related to financial difficulty that was going on at that time. In the year 2000, my client, Cal Klinger, was having to turn all of his income over to his creditors. That's what his testimony was. He was renting that farm from his mother. Because the creditors took his money, he couldn't pay the rent to his mother. Because his mother wasn't getting the rent, she couldn't pay the Farm Credit Bank payment, and as a result, the Farm Credit Bank started a foreclosure action. Well, so the other children jump in, and they want to save their mother. Well, even before the other children jumped in, the mother and Cal already had a plan going to rectify the deal. Cal was going to give up his lease. He was going to lease it to this guy named Gail Tennant, and they were going to have a sale of personal property. That was the plan they had in place. The evidence is real clear. That plan was, they were working on it.
But the 320-acre disposition remained constant. Is that right?
That's right.
And that's that is your point.
Yeah, just because...
What is the difference between the 2001 will and the 2011 will?
Really, the main difference was Orrin Klinger would never let his mother out from under that conservatorship. She tried and tried and tried to get out from under it. So in 2005, John Wolf, an attorney for Marianne, tried to terminate the conservatorship. Orrin Klinger fought her. Orrin Klinger won. Orrin Klinger asked for his attorney fees to be awarded. County court didn't allow him. Appealed to district court. District court allowed the attorney fees, $3,600. The main change in that 2011 will was she deducted that $3,600 from his share of the estate. And Attorney Herman, who drafted the will in 2011, you know, gave the reason that she wasn't doing that in a vindictive way. She did it because he already got that, so it was going to be deducted from his inheritance. So that was the main difference, Your Honor. So, but I really want to emphasize that tape was good evidence of undue influence, and the jury was never instructed not to consider the tape at all related to undue influence. They just told to ignore the statements where the words undue influence were used. On the presumption, I don't know if you want to hear any more about that, but you know that I don't think a presumption ever arose because as part of our case in chief, we could have just thrown the will into evidence because it was a self-proved will. But we had two witnesses, Mr. Norman, who was there when the will was signed and had met with Marianne previously regarding trying to terminate that conservatorship. And also his legal assistant, Janice Chesnowski, testified when we put the will into evidence.
Well, I mean, the production of evidence and the burden of proof starts with the contestant to the will, doesn't it?
Could you repeat yourself?
The burden of proof starts with the contestant to the will, doesn't it? The will's offered.
Right.
And then the contestant has to show that it was the subject of incompetence of the testator or undue influence of the testator or undue influence upon the testator.
Right. You're correct, Your Honor, and Mr. Norman's testimony and Ms. Chesnowski's testimony was so strong when we put the will into evidence, I don't think there was never a shifting of the burden of evidence after that. Even if there was, you can look at the briefs.
But he didn't have any burden at the start. You already had a self-proved will.
That's right.
You didn't have any burden to begin with, did you?
That's right, and nothing ever got, the burden of evidence never did get shifted to us either. I mean, if you want to look at certain parts of the record and say, oh, maybe that shifted the burden because maybe there was some...
Was there confusion over what was meant by the greater weight of the evidence?
Well, I don't think so, Your Honor. The jury, if you look at the record, the jury was deadlocked. Actually, it was the final vote was 8-4, and if you look at the record, I think Mr. Holbrook suggested that we stipulate to a lower number than 10 votes in favor of one way or the other. So we did, and came back 8-4. And so they were feuding in there, and they started asking questions. The questions just kept getting more and more bizarre, actually. So I think the judge did the right thing. He had instructed them correctly about the greater weight of the evidence. And when they came back and asked, well, beyond a shadow of a doubt, sounded like somebody was watching too much TV there. But he said, well, no. Instructions, proper, go back, read it again. It just reflected the dispute that the jury was having there, and which happens a lot with juries, as you might guess. So, anyway, there was a significant amount of evidence that would have always kept the burden of evidence on the appellants in this case. So there was no question that there shouldn't have been an instruction. If you want to talk about it getting complicated, then try to instruct that jury about some presumption that existed. I think you pointed out something very clear there about the previous case law in Hedke. That was a bench trial. So you really didn't get into the issues about how a jury should be instructed in that case. Plus, you look at the evidence of the case where they say there was a presumption. Nowak and Hedke. And those, Nowak, the contestant, didn't even get a chance to put on any evidence. That's why that one got reversed. And then Headke was a bench trial, and there was a lot of bad evidence against the son, who was the will proponent in that case. And there was really no question that the judge, district judge, hadn't looked at that properly. And
Mr. Vinton, are you aware of any cases from this court that we've ever said that a jury should be instructed regarding a prejudice or presumption of undue influence?
No, I've searched hard. I didn't find any. All I've seen is just the theory discussed, you know, legal principles that could apply, but I've never seen it happen. I tried to find something. I don't have any more to say. Any other questions?
Thank you very much. Do we have time for rebuttal? There is no time for rebuttal. We will go on to the next case of the day, which is In Re Interest of Joseph F. S.